You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 10th of February 2016 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Tuck. On today's show, the New Hampshire results are in, and they're not entirely unexpected. But with Sanders and Trump both calling victory, it's a far cry from where many thought this year's race would lead. Also ahead, America's defense spending is heading downwards. Critics say it proves just how little President Obama understands about America's enemies. Do they have a point? We'll also look at France as MPs throw their support behind a bill set to strip citizenship from those convicted of terrorism. And why is Italy's Prime Minister comparing the European Union to a band playing aboard the Titanic? That's all to come on Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck. And welcome to Midori House. My guest today, Robert Fox, who's the defence editor at the Evening Standard newspaper here in London, and Xenia Wickett, who's the project director at the US programme at Chatham House. And there's only one place really to start today. That's the win by Donald Trump and the win by Bernie Sanders in the caucus in New Hampshire. Now, we could set this up in lots of different ways, but let's just dive straight in, Xenia. First of all, let's look on the Democratic side. A margin of some 20%. Now, even I was doing a show just here yesterday and they were saying, wow, it looks like it might be closer to 8-9%. That was an extraordinary margin of win. What does it mean for Hillary Clinton? Is this just one of these passing moments? Because there's a feeling that she's absolutely failing to connect to women voters, to young voters, that all the demographics we thought would be behind her, they're just not there.
Well, I think you're seeing something similar, not the same, but similar happen on the Democratic and the Republican side, which is in both cases, whether you're talking about Bernie Sanders or you're talking about Donald Trump, they are connecting to a part of the electorate that feels disenfranchised, that feels left behind, that feels that while America's growth may be back at 2.5%, they're not seeing any of it. And in the case of Bernie Sanders, this is not entirely, but a large proportion of the support that he's getting is from young voters. Even the female voters are principally young voters, not exclusively, but principally. People who are coming out of university and can't find jobs. And on the Trump side, this is, again, principally, not exclusively, but principally, the factions that are supporting him are those that have come out of, haven't finished their high school or didn't do a degree. Again, those who are disenfranchised, those who can't find jobs, those who are finding technology are taking their jobs and who feel that immigrants are taking their jobs. And they're both, so in both sides, they're appealing to very different factions of the United States, but parts of the United States that are disempowered. They can't be ignored. I mean, what this is saying, it doesn't necessarily mean that Hillary needs to go far left or you know, that the mainstream Republican candidates need to go far right. But it does mean that they have to actually recognize, take into consideration, and find solutions to, across America, to those who are getting left behind by the system. And this is happening not just in the United States, but it's happening across Europe as well.
I was going to say, they're tapping into the same thing, you know, Podemos, Syriza, Front National, they're all kind of pulling into the same kind of narrative. Robert, do you see that kind of unified, kind of slightly anti-establishment, not trusting central government, feeling someone somewhere is kind of pulling the strings on the machine?
Yeah, but I think it's something that's been going on for nearly 30 years, because what we have seen is so strongly the rhetoric, let's just take Britain and America, of diminishing the role of the state, and going with that is the thing, we'll not have high taxes anymore. So the upper end brackets get their taxes reduced. Sorry, this is not my idea. This is Professor Sir Paul Collier at Oxford. And it's very, very interesting. From what Xenia has just been saying, it's absolutely clear we've got the squeezed middle here. It's the middle income. They haven't benefited from this. Yes, then you get the xenophobic things about fears that it's immigrants, new arrivals who are taking the jobs, they're getting employed. Because one thing that that was so strong in the narrative of the reporting, as I was reading and listening to it from New Hampshire particularly, is anger and rage, is that the sense that that history has passed them by, And I think there was another thing that's very worrying connected to that. There was a pretty high turnout, I think, even by the standards of New Hampshire. It's not necessarily directed against the incumbent, against Obama. It's somehow, you know, Washington has left us out of the deal. And this is very, very strong. I think I agree with you. You can read across in America, you can from America to Europe, and in any number of countries that are having elections, from the Netherlands, Italy, next year, certainly Germany. It's the people who feel that we are the residents, but we're the left behind residents. And that will play very, very strongly in the plebiscite. In other words, the referendum for the EU and the UK.
Zenia, what do you make of the argument that Donald Trump is doing mighty well now, but it's because there's such a big field? If you strip out, because there's a huge number of kind of slightly traditional candidates standing behind him, if they begin to get, you know, whittled out over the coming weeks and there's only kind of one other person standing next to him, that in comparison, he may begin to suffer.
It depends on who that other person is. So, I mean, you know, realistically, you can, right at the moment, you can split the Republican field into two principal groups. You've got the kind of non-establishment, we're not Washington, D.C., although one of them is Washington, D.C., but nevertheless, we're not Washington, D.C., we're different, Donald Trump and Ted Cruz. You know, kind of, and this is less about their policies, by the way, but this is somewhat about their policies, but it's actually more the kind of rebels, mavericks, et cetera, et cetera. And then you've got the kind of mainstream Republicans, which you can put in Kasich, Bush, Christie, Rubio, and again, quite different policies, quite different positions, but, you know, you can broadly put them into those two groups. What is likely to happen quite possibly in the next week, Christie will fall out. He came sixth in New Hampshire. He had staked a lot on New Hampshire, didn't do well in Iowa. He's running out of money. So Christie will go. Kasich staked everything on New Hampshire, did well, but it's unlikely that he's going to do well in, particularly well in either Nevada or South Carolina. So on the kind of moderate, if you will, mainstream Republican side, you're going to be left with Rubio and Bush. And on the conservative, non-establishment, maverick side, if you will, you're going to be left with Trump and Cruz. And then you're going to see kind of a head-to-head within those two factions. And it's going to be really interesting to see how that plays out, because on the kind of conservative side, Trump and Cruz. Cruz won the first battle, Iowa. Trump's won the second battle, New Hampshire. We'll see what happens in the next couple of states. And Rubio and Bush. Bush is more the establishment candidate than Rubio's. People have real concerns about Rubio. He's too young. He looks too much like Obama. He did a lousy job last Saturday in the debates. You know, it will be interesting to see how that one plays out. And, you know, once Christie leaves, once Kasich leaves, and their voters go to someone else.
Just tell people who don't know all the intricacies of US politics, how long before you have to have made a decision on the Republican side?
So what's interesting, I mean, the American side, the American voting process is hugely democratic, very, very robust, and highly complex and at times illogical. So you have to start with the premise that this is not sensible. So there's a caucus and a primary. Some states have caucuses, some states have primaries. The bottom line is, as you go through these caucus primary processes, you pick up delegates depending on how many votes you win. Sometimes it's, if you win a state, you get all of the delegates. Sometimes if you win a state, you get a percentage of the delegates. You need a certain number of delegates to actually get the nomination this summer at the Republican at the Republican convention. So some point, you know, March, April-ish, the Democrats start stacking up on one another candidate and we know who it's going to be and everybody else starts dropping out. This could go on a lot longer on the Republican side.
Robert, we've seen some hints from Mike Bloomberg, the former mayor of New York, that he may enter the race because he's seeing this kind of polarized America and he's feeling, although he was once a Republican, became an independent, that he could kind of march through the middle as, you know, this kind of, you know, somebody who would appeal to all sorts of people. Do you think that's a likely, you know, we've never seen an independent do incredibly well, but do you think he could have a good run?
independents are always round and about, and I always think of the Ross Perot factor. But the thing is that Bloomberg actually did a very good quote today in the New York Times from him. He sort of more or less said, he's putting his hand up, was probably in this race, and it's a testament to Hillary's failure that he can say this and get away with it. He's more or less the only grown-up around. He said that the campaign had been so dreary and so irresponsible so far, he really was thinking of running. And, of course, he doesn't have to, because he'll run as an independent, to go through all the primaries and caucuses that Zenia has just described to us. I think what is very interesting, if we could just do the Democrat, and I'd be very interested to know what you think about this, is that we've got two oldsters there. And the thing is that, and she's the same age as me, Hillary is looking really old and sounding really old, and she doesn't know how to play the establishment card, which I find so extraordinary. She's trying to pretend she was involved in this, that, the other, and protest and so on. For God's sake, she's actually been in government. She's been so close to government, and she should say, look, what I have learned from that. The trouble is, apart from her, with Sanders, with Trump, with the various others, I'd be very worried that foreign policy was in their hands, in view of some of the things they've been saying hitherto, including Sanders, by the way.
Just quickly on the Bloomberg ticket, an appealing option? Because I understand it's even just getting his name on all the ballots is super complicated.
So, I mean, the first thing to note is Bloomberg brings his own money to the table, so there's a lot he can get done quickly that if you don't have the money, you can't. The second thing to say on Bloomberg is he's made it very, very clear he's only coming in if he doesn't see a credible alternative. That credible alternative, in his mind, is almost certainly going to be Clinton. He will only come in if it looks like Sanders could win the Democratic nominee, if Trump or Cruz wins the Republican nominee, in which case he actually has, in my view, a decent chance to come in as an independent and be credible. If, however, Clinton becomes the nominee but is very broken, he says he will come in. Again, it assumes that Trump or Cruz get the Republican nominee. And if that's the case, then we have a somewhat scary scenario where you could actually get a Cruz or a Trump president, because Bloomberg would take away votes from Clinton more than anybody else. And so you do actually have this really interesting kind of situation that I don't think we've had credibly in the last few decades, where...
True.
You've got two candidates potentially that are so far in the extreme in the way of Sanders and Trump or Cruz that you've got a whole space in the middle that an independent can come in with their own money and actually get something done. But it would be extremely dangerous were he to come in if Hillary does actually get the nominee, because then he and Hillary split the kind of left-center votes.
It's fascinating stuff, and I think we're going to be dipping into this again and again over the coming days. We're going to stay in the US. Tom Cotton is a Republican senator from Arkansas and no big fan of Mr. Obama. But in an editorial published by Defense One, he's lashed out at what he's called an ignorant decision by the US president to spend $2.3 billion fewer on defense than last year. Senator Cotton cited Russian aggression and China's activities in the South China Sea as key concerns. And there's terrorism too. I know that you're both chomping to dive into this. Mr. Fox, what do you make of this accusation?
It's Mandy Rice Davis, isn't it? He would say it, wouldn't he? He's actually 2. Whatever it is, billion less. It's a pretty balanced budget, and a lot of the innuendo is not true. He has allocated from and asked for a vote for $7.9 billion for fighting ISIS. And he's put a one-off extra 3.9 into this rotating forward disposition of materiel and potential reinforcement troops for Poland. This is very serious now, by the way. And this is concentrated on serious aspects of security and foreign policy. And I think that it is very, very sensible. But there are things about, you know, the posture very severely criticised again in a news piece in the New York Times today about the Syrian campaign, which is going very, very badly wrong because the proxies, the supporters on the ground of choice are absolutely failing and are at the mercy of the Russians. You can criticise him on that. From the high points of the Bush presidency, for goodness sake, the American defense budget had to come in. And as far as things go, things are pretty, pretty reasonable, and they are warning about the various things that you've got to keep an eye on. the South China Sea. I do think the aircraft carrier policy, which has been out of control hitherto, is a lot better than it was. And the other thing is that Mr. Obama and Mr. Kerry are very, very mindful of what is going on in the Gulf of Sirte and Libya at the moment. Probably, as much as the Italian Prime Minister, we're going to talk about it in another context, Mr. Cameron, who's very much with it, and the trio there. I think there are problems with Syria, but on the posture, which is what we're talking about, and what they're paying for, I think cotton is nowhere there.
But just quickly, without dwelling on too long, on the shopping list front, did Obama have the right shopping list? So, Tom Cotton is saying that he should have bought more subs. He should have bought more. He's buying the wrong stuff. It's not just what he's spending on. He's buying the wrong kit.
No, I think he's buying the right kit, actually, because, I mean, things like subs are coming on. They're incredibly expensive, and you do have to take your time over that. It's all very well to go in for this broad brush stuff, but actually just investing in kit is not really the answer. It is really, and the Americans are saying this across the alliance, and the Germans particularly, and the UK and the French are following them. It's things like ISTAR, command and control, surveillance, that kind of thing is absolutely vital, and they are spending on that.
Zane, we've heard, Trump, make America great. We're going to kind of build up our armed forces. We don't have enough people, et cetera, et cetera. What do you make of this argument about spending?
So, I mean, I think this is a fascinating piece. I mean, you have to remember, first of all, Tom Cotton was a senator who actually, about 8 months ago, drafted a letter to the Iranian people saying, even if we sign a deal with you, we're not going to follow through. I mean, he's the one who led the charge in the Senate and House to essentially start talking to the Iranians without... I mean, this man is... It's hard to... Frankly, it's hard to really respect somebody who is talking to the opposition rather than talking to the home crowd and is now talking about defence and that we should take him seriously on defence. The other thing is, the real problem on defence, the first problem on defence, isn't how much we spend. It's actually politically being able to spend the way we want to spend, not the way the politicians want us to spend. So the other irony on this is, of course, if you talk to the generals, they will tell you, we've got the money, but we need to shut bases. Here are the pieces of equipment we need to stop buying, or we need to take off our list. And it's America's politicians in Congress who don't let them do it because the base happens to be in their state.
It's always been thus.
Yeah. So I mean, I think we have to stop for a moment critiquing the top number, and we actually have to start talking about what is the political process in the United States whereby the generals aren't listened to when they say this is what we need and this is what we want. And that's a problem with Congress.
Well, we're going to take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House, here with me, Andrew Tuck, Robert Fox and Xenia Wickett. Coming up next, French MPs throw their support behind a plan to strip citizenship from convicted terrorists. Stay tuned.
Monocle Films celebrates the publication of our latest travel guide with a cinematic ode to Rio de Janeiro. We explore this city full of surprises to show that Rio's beauty is not just skin deep.
Few cities have married themselves to the landscape quite like Rio de Janeiro. It's no wonder Rio's architects and designers have been inspired by its undulating tropical topography since the city was founded. Giants of Brazilian architecture have left their mark here, and Brazilian designers have put Rio firmly on the map too.
The Monocle Travel Guide to Rio, a filmic sampler now showing in the film section of monocle.com.
We're raising the curtain on a brand new show here on Monocle 24 devoted to the best in cinema. Tune in every week to hear from filmmakers, critics, and luminaries of the genre as we shine a spotlight on everything from revivals and the restoration of vintage cuts to Hollywood's golden age and the role of the auteur.
I never think of architecture or cities or landscapes in cinema as merely being a kind of neutral backdrop to the action. They are the action themselves.
Hear feature-length interviews with the biggest names, roundtable discussions, special reports, and more as Monocle 24 delves into the rich history of the silver screen. The cinema show on Monocle 24, in association with MUBI, premiering Fridays at 20:00 London time, because life is too short for bad films.
Well,
Well, debate has been raging while you've been listening to that. Welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24. Still with me is Robert Fox and Xenia Wickett. The most controversial change to France's constitution in the wake of November's terrorist attack is a step closer today after the French Parliament approved the proposal's first stage. The new law would see those convicted of terrorism stripped of their citizenship, prompting heated debate and even the resignation of the country's justice minister. France is right, says it's a gesture with little practical effect, while the nation's left, some within the president's own party indeed, say the changes would only apply to those with dual citizenship anyway. International law prohibits France from making any of its citizens stateless. Now, at the heart of this, I guess, is just a natural instinct, Xenia, which is say, OK, you've committed a terrorist act. You weren't born in our country. Go away. Let's strip you of your citizenship. What's wrong with that as a basic instinct?
At some level, I mean, it's a basic instinct that everybody can understand. But, I mean, the issue here, I think, is one of how effective is this going to be? You know, I mean, is this actually going to really change anything? I mean, to some extent, this really resonates as a political statement so that they can say that they've done something, not something that's going to have an impact. Because as you pointed out, unless those individuals have dual nationality, it is illegal. It is you're not allowed to strip. You're not allowed to make an individual stateless. Whether you're France or you're England or you're the United States, you can't make an individual stateless. So unless they have dual nationality and they can choose another nationality, you can't take away the French citizenship. And so this is, you know, we're talking about infinitesimal numbers, even if it actually happens. So this is, I think, far more a political statement than it is a real policy that is intended to have any real impact.
Robert, we've seen here, even in the UK, attempts to deport people back to their country of origin once they've got a British passport. It gets caught up in in court after court. You know, it goes to the European Court of Human Rights. It's almost impossible to do it. Is this a bit of kind of showmanship? Because even if they pass this law, surely it will not get past all of those institutions.
Sorry, what are we talking about? France or the UK now?
France now. Yeah. But I'm just saying the UK is a good example. We tried it. You can't do it.
The UK is still going to try certain things, but you're not going to be able to put even a razor paper between myself and my fellow speaker here. I think it is gesture. I think it is grandstanding because, in practical effect, it's just a dozen or so people at most. I am absolutely against expulsion of people to go out into a nether region and then they will be active again, because we know everything about it. They are here. They are in our citizenship because they're in our virtual citizenship. And that's the thing. Have we not learned anything from the proselytization by Aulaki? You know, the American citizen who was very reasonable when 9/11 happened, goes to Yemen, goes to the the Arab Peninsula, becomes absolutely the most effective cyber recruiter to date, I would think, of all time. This is playing to the gallery. I am against stripping people of that because I think it's also the responsibility of the state in which it happens and to which they belong to deal with it. And I'm quite hard-line about it. I'm also very worried because I'm reading a lot of the background of this, including out tomorrow, David Kilcullen's excellent new book about the last year with jihadism. And he is very critical of the French rhetorical stance, particularly post 13th of November, because what did Hollande do for all the emotional reasons, if you can have such, that are understandable? He declared war on terrorism again and yet again. And so we go round. If you are going to declare these initiatives, they've got to have real meaning. And it's not just sending an aircraft carrier, which he then did, as you know, to the eastern end of the Mediterranean and up the tempo for a week of the bombing raids on Raqqa. It's more complicated. It is more serious than that. And I don't think that this move will deter anybody at all, but it's another propaganda point to the other side.
Well,
that's a bit tough.
I think, seeing as you both agree and I can't get a fight going, I'm going to move on. Because finally tonight, Italy's Prime Minister is making no secret of his ambition to secure a spot at Europe's steering wheel, but comments he made earlier this week during an interview with Bloomberg seem to have reached a new level. After comparing Europe to the band playing on the deck of a sinking Titanic, Matteo Renzi wasted no breath selling his country's credentials, while outlining the need for the EU to funnel its financial and military strengths where it wields greatest influence. Renzi also said it was essential the Union recognise the limits of its power and perhaps, most controversially, reconcile itself with Russia. Is this controversial to make friends again with Russia?
For Renzi in his position, and particularly the part of the spectrum of Italian politics that he comes from, this is absolutely in all of a piece. And it is completely understandable. And remember, he is Partito Democratico, which would come from the old PCI, which did have the line, the human face of Moscow through Togliatti and Berlinguer. That's how Eurocommunism came there. So there's a little bit of that going on in the background. Far more important is the first part of your proposition, is that what young Matteo Renzi imagines himself to be, a Tony Blair, but who went straight. He is the Tony Blair, what Tony Blair should have been before he went bonkers in the Renzi critique and invading Iraq and outbushing Bush in the war on terror and so on, rhetorically speaking. And he is the reasonable voice that can do a lot of things, that can reconcile the inside and the outside of the EU. He comes from the south but speaks the language of the north. I mean, this is the way he plays it. And this is why Italy can be the pivot country. What he is sensing, back to the Blair thing, I think there's an obsession with the UK here. What he is sensing is the UK is pulling out and he thinks Italy can go into the space. Now, just having worked for years and years in that country, as you know, I think it's absolutely delusory. I think he's deluding himself. The economy, I don't know if anyone will agree with me, is still doing damn badly. And for all the bluster, now we're prepared to be positive. We've contributed to this. We're there in Iraq and we want help and we'll lead this new so-called security and peace operation in Libya, which they're really talking up big time. No, it doesn't work, because that's where the French and the Germans particularly want the Brits in, because the Brits are the key link of the European allies in the EU to NATO. And you can only really do big things with EU allies if you have NATO, and particularly its planning capacity involved in it, with the US standing back, because they are so many generations ahead in planning and execution. And this is why, sorry, I hope, like Aladdin's lamp, that Mr. Renzi's rhetoric has gone up in a puff of blue smoke.
Zenia, he seems like a modernizer to many people. He seems to have good ambitions regarding potentially what should happen in Libya. But there is also some trade-off going here. Yeah, he wants more help, re-migration. He obviously feels a little bit kind of snubbed by the EU in a way. How do you judge his actions?
So I think there's two real points to make. I mean, first of all, you have to recognise, that he is, he's almost, I don't feel quite as strongly as Robert, but that he is hiding his economic problems in a foreign policy assertion. So Italy still has huge economic challenges. He admits to those huge economic challenges. He wants an easier ride from the EU and IMF and others in order to deal with those economic challenges. And he's almost kind of saying, OK, I can just shuffle these behind because, hey, I'm this great foreign policy leader and I'm going to do so much for Europe as a new leader. So, I mean, I think first it is to recognise that some of this is a purely political calculation, I think, that he can hide the economics behind the foreign policy. The second part is, from a purely theoretical level, would it be a good thing if Italy were able to stand up and be a leader alongside France, Germany and the UK within Europe in the foreign policy space? Absolutely. But in order to be a leader, it's not just the will to lead, which he clearly has. It also requires the capabilities to lead, back to economy. They don't have the capabilities to lead. They don't have the resources to lead. They don't have the military capabilities or the diplomatic capabilities. Right at the moment, they are absolutely struggling with their own economy, and they have been underspending for I don't know how long. So, and they've got their politics. Don't forget their politics. And so, great that he has an intent and will. Unless he has the capabilities, it's not going to be real. So I kind of a little softer, perhaps than my colleague here, but basically the same point.
I know you want to dive in. We've got 15 seconds. Do you think there'd be a good team to run the Libya program?
They seem to be reconciled to it. The Brits have said that they will go in and help him run the headquarters of the operation, but the given is that the really heavy backup will be done by the US. But absolutely, he has run down defence budgets at his predecessors in a way that has made it ludicrous.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there. Robert Fox and Zinnia Wickett, thank you so much for joining me on Midori House. That's all we have time for on the show today. It was produced by Ben Ryland. It was researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Yasmin Omar. And our studio manager was Toby Hammond. International Players continues next. Then 1900 Hours is Danny Jogopele with The Entrepreneurs. But from me, Andrew Tuck, it's just time to say thank you and goodbye.